Let's do it. We've got Adam Stokes on the show today, biblical scholar, theologian, researcher. Talk to us about ancient giants and more about prehistory and maybe some thoughts on Bigfoot too. You never know what the next guest is going to bring to the table, right, Luke?
Life is like a box of chocolates.
You never know what
you're going to get.
Blurry Creatures is a box of chocolates.
Dude, why don't you give the people what they want? Do a little Yoda for us.
Oh, blurry creatures.
Oh, you've been practicing, pal. It's good. It's real good.
Yeah, if you've been on our Instagram, you've been seeing some, I don't know, one-of-a-kind memes. I mean, there's memes, and then there's blurry creature memes. We take them a little bit to the next level, I guess.
I'm still waiting for Roadhouse.
Yeah, I mean, I know.
What do I got to do to get a Roadhouse?
Many people know, like, the deep dive of the 80s. Like,
dude, that's not even deep dive. It's one of the greatest movies of the 80s.
But I'm just saying, everyone knows Back to the Future.
Star Wars.
It's just easy. It's obvious. And I can do Yoda's voice, bro. I can't.
You can't do. What about Predator? Can we do some Dylan? You son of a bitch.
I need to get you in there.
I just got to start getting that Arnold warmed up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
that was close. I kind of made out what you were saying there.
I wasn't saying anything. It was just like one of those Arnold like grunt yells.
The history of our Earth is so different from what we can imagine.
Enjoy the journey.
The Smithsonian, that if they found out about a large skeleton somewhere, was to go get it.
I'm going to assume at least one person is right, because if one person's right, it busts the paradigm.
It all goes back to the fallen cherub. And the problem with the modern day church, they have a very truncated view of the supernatural.
This backdrop that's just pregnant with all kinds of meaning associated with this Mount Hermon event.
And this guy defects from the kingdom. That's a big deal.
Welcome to the show, Adam Stokes. You are biblical scholar, theologian, researcher, and a lover of history. I have a degree in religious studies from Duke University and Yale Divinity School, and you did your doctoral work at Princeton Theological Seminary. Well, you've written on a lot of the subjects that we talk about a lot on our show: prehistory, pre-Columbian American history, mounds, ancient giants, connections between Native Americans and the mounds, and earthworks, biblical sites. Well, thanks for coming on the show. We messaged a long time on Instagram trying to make this happen, but, you know, life is wild and it takes a while, but people come on the show when they're meant to come on the show. You said you've been listening to the show for a while, so you kind of know a little bit of maybe some of the things we do, some of our familiar topics, but like we always do, what are your thoughts on Bigfoot? Let's just launch into it. You got any thoughts on that creature?
Yeah, I think that I have a couple of friends who are researchers who have done serious work on Bigfoot, looking at the traditions in Native American lore and some of the recent documentation on it. And they have, you know, they put out some stuff that's really damn interesting and that really can't be refuted. And I think Bigfoot is one of those creatures like the Mothman, et cetera, that we have, you know, in North America that may go back, tying this all into giants and stuff like that, to a previously unknown race or species here in North America that we're trying to figure out. We label him Bigfoot or Harry and the Hendersons. But, you know, it's possible that, you know, whatever this is is a remnant or, you know, a continuation of these amazing, fascinating races that were here thousands of years ago on this continent.
Do you think it's related to the Nephilim topics that we talk about a lot on the show?
You know, it's interesting because I have kind of an interesting take on the Nephilim. I know a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my friends take them as kind of these, you know, fallen angels. And one of the things, you know, that is a possible interpretation for the term Nephilim, which surely means the fallen ones. For myself, I've always given it kind of a less, extraterrestrial or less supernatural explanation, that it just refers to an ancient civilization of giants who fell from their former glory, from their former status. Look at the giants of North America, kind of the history of the Hopewell and Edina giants, for example, and their history and how their civilization just collapsed, and apply the term Nephilim to that, then yes, I think that there is possibly a connection there, that this Bigfoot may be a remnant of this giant race, or these races of giants that once inhabited North America.
Awesome. And how did you get into all of these topics? A lot of people have interesting roads that leads them to start researching these topics, because it's not a popular topic, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, Nate. It kind of goes back to my background in biblical studies. I was always fascinated with biblical giants. Like I said, like you said, I was doing a doctorate at Princeton. It didn't quite work out, but what I was doing my work on was looking at these quote-unquote mythical figures that you get in the Old Testament in books such as Job, Leviathan, Behemoth. So I've always had a fascination with ancient creatures, and kind of more personally, whether these creatures have a basis in fact, which I think a lot of them in fact do. So that was one impetus. And then the other impetus was my own religious background. I'm from a Latter-day Saint tradition. I'm not part of the main Mormon church in Utah. I'm part of a smaller tradition. But there's a belief that kind of connects all these traditions, that there were ancient inhabitants from the Near East that came to North America. And that got me interested in looking at the history of ancient America and ancient civilizations in North America. So those are kind of my two roads into these topics.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we've talked about that, I mean, in some terms, Nate, like whether it be like the Phoenicians or, you know, the Old Testament, when the nations were scattered, we even had an interview with Dr. Laura Sanger talking about a race of giants that may have lived on Jekyll Island and surrounding areas off of Georgia. And then you brought up, there's the caves, there's yellow hair, there's all these different, and these beings were didn't look like the Native Americans, right? And so
no, as even the Native Americans attest to, right. You know, a lot of pushback when you talk about giants, a lot in ancient civilizations in North America, a lot of people will say, you know, a lot of critics will say, hey, well, you're just kind of ignoring the Native American cultures and saying that this other group came in. And what I try to say is that, one, no, I'm not doing that. I have the highest respect for Native American culture. And two, within their own traditions, within the traditions of Native American peoples, they say that these giants were of a different race and a different group from themselves, that they came from somewhere else, and that they were hostile to them. And arguments I make in my book, From Egypt to Ohio, is that, you know, these giants came straight from the Near East, from the biblical region, and that they are ultimately connected with the Nephilim, this fallen race of giants, this fallen civilization that you get in the Bible.
Talk us through that, because that's fascinating to me. That's something we haven't talked about. Like, specifically, you wrote about, this is where you're an expert. Can you lay out some of that for us, as far as you're talking about the Hope and Earthworks, right? Is that where...
Yeah, exactly.
And those are in Ohio. And then so if you're listening and you're more or less like me, I don't know a lot about that. I know there's a lot of giant mounds. We had Fritz Zimmerman on. He spent an exhaustive amount of time going mound to mound to mound, and then doing other weird stuff like time travel and stuff. Time stoppage, whatever Fritz says he did. But I think we've talked a lot about giants here, Adam, on the show. We talked a bit about North America, but I think we've talked a lot in terms of Old Testament. We've talked with Travis, and he's been collecting, one of our friends has come in collecting articles of people digging up giants from the 1800s into the early 1900s, before that whole thing just disappeared. Poof. But yeah, walk us through a little bit of what's going on in Ohio and what, you know, and your work.
Yeah, this was, I didn't know about any of this stuff, Luke, until I started kind of doing research on my own, you know, about 4 or 5 years back. I started to get in touch with people like Wayne May, who does, editor of Ancient American Magazine. So this was just something I came to through my own interest in trying to learn about ancient pre-Columbian American history, and really kind of coming to the conclusion that it's much different than what we're normally taught in schools. And the Ohio tradition is just so fascinating with the two groups, the Hopewell and Avena. That's not their original names. The Native Americans just called them mound builders. Later on, scholars gave these groups those names because those were the that was, I believe, the property. The dude was named Hopewell. Another was named Hopewell. Another dude was named Adina. And so they gave the names of the property owners in the 19th century to these ancient peoples. But very fascinating. They had a very sophisticated civilization, not just in Ohio, but stretching all the way down to even Kentucky and Mississippi and Alabama. Last October, I was at a conference for my church, and I was able to see right down the street from me, from my hotel, was an Adena mound in Louisville, Kentucky. So they basically, their empire was enormous. You can imagine from where Louisville is all the way to Ohio. And on my way back, I actually got to drive through and visit a bunch of the Ohio mounds. So Fort Ancient, the Newark Earthworks, they're all kind of on this grid showing that, you know, the Hopewell had, you know, basically structured out their empire throughout the United States. So very well organized. And in a lot of these, like you said, in the 19th century, going into the early 20th century, started to find remains of giants who were at least 7 feet to 9 feet in height. The culture was just very, very different in some ways from what we have in the surrounding culture. So they're buried with gold items, with jewelry, seems to be a like deliberate religious practices, which in my book, I show the parallels with to ancient Israelite practices. And so just a very distinct culture, but one that is preserved in the race memory of a lot of Native American traditions. At the end of the day, these giants don't seem to have been very nice. They came into conflict with people, with the people of the land, the Native Americans. And eventually, either through conflict with the Native inhabitants or through conflict with each other, they die out. The Native American traditions, as well as what appears to be the cultures themselves, attest to these giants coming from someplace else. So they are not indigenous to North America, but they had a strong, pervasive presence in this country. And remnants of their civilization are left. Most notably in these mounds.
Adam, I have a question, a follow-up question. So we've had Derek Olson on, who's a friend of the show, and he's megalithic marvels. Yeah. We've talked a lot about theories about these megaliths that the giants may or may not have helped build. One of the prevailing theories is they did because things are massive and there was obviously some different technology. Yeah. They built with stone, and what we're seeing and we see here in, you know, in Ohio and in the Ohio Valley and Louisville, even outside here in Nashville, we've got a mound Nate and I went out to one night unsuccessfully trying to figure out what it was. Why are they building with earth? Is it what, I mean, did you come across anything? Because I've always been kind of fascinated with the idea that we look at South America and there's these massive stone structures. There's plenty of stone, I would say, here in Tennessee where we're at.
The giants smoked a lot more weed out over here.
If they're coming from the Middle East and we're talking about these being, you know, specifically displaced people since they were scattered, and the assumption is a lot of them were running, you know, as Joshua and the Israelites were essentially cleaning house.
Eating up,
These giants were fleeing because they were being annihilated. Any thoughts on the earthworks thing? It seems very unique and specific, really, to what goes on here in the States.
That's an awesome question. That's a really, really good question. I think that, you know, a couple of things are going on. With the earthworks, I think it's important to note, and I get this when people say, well, I've been to an earthwork, and I know there's never been any giants in there. There are some earthworks that are imitations of earlier earthworks. Then there are some earthworks that on the surface look like it's just, you know, just earth and dirt and stuff like that. But underneath, they do kind of have a structure with, you know, stone and stuff like that, kind of like what you get, for example, with an Egyptian pyramid. We also have to remember, just like with the Egyptian pyramids, these things were a hell of a lot more decorated, hell of a lot more lavish, at least from what archaeologists and researchers are able to reconstruct, than what they look now. So you see, if you go to Newark Earthworks, It just seems like clumps of dirt. But back in, you know, thousands of years ago, these were structures that had stone workings with them. So they looked much more elaborate than they do now. I think that for the Hopewell and Edina mound, I think that the mound builders themselves, these giants, they were more concerned about recreating kind of the dimensions, the spiritual dimensions of places where they previously lived, of places where they previously resided, such as in the Near East. I think they were concerned more about the dimensions, recreating those dimensions, than actually creating an exact replica. You know, they may not have known how to, like you said, there's stone around, but they can't. They may have forgotten how to use it in the same way that their ancestors used it in the Near East. But they have an idea of what the dimensions are, and so they try to imitate that. Because ultimately, from a religious perspective, it's dimensions of the temple. It's the dimension of these religious sites that you want in order to, you know, reestablish contact with whatever deity or god that you're worshiping. I'll also note one last thing, which is that, interestingly enough, there are sites in Britain as well as in Canada, what is now Canada, that are very similar to the earthworks. So you have mounds that have some stone in them, but are mainly made of earth, and you get something similar in North America. And that, for me, is an example of...
I've been to one, actually. Now you say that. I've been to New Grange in Ireland.
Oh, nice.
Which is a lot. Now I think of that, what you're describing is that.
Yeah.
It's a stone megalith that's actually covered with earth, and they can't really figure out. I think it's a tomb, but there's nothing in it, which is also really interesting. There's no bones, and it has these very specific alignment things. And so I think that's interesting what you're talking about, because I think also the assumption, I think, is a lot of that is post-flood, right? And so we see the same thing in South America. We see what we consider to be maybe pre-flood construction of these megaliths, and then when after, it's almost like that technology was forgotten and wiped out, right? You have the Incas, the Aztecs, and their buildings are much cruder, but they're trying to build on and replicate what was happening.
I think you raise a great point, Luke, which is that, you know, we as modern people, you know, if we forget how to build something, we just say, oh, I'll look on the blueprints of this construction worker or something like that. We don't appreciate how fast people forgot things in the ancient world. You know, if it wasn't passed down immediately, then there was a chance that it wasn't going to be passed down at all. And you see this kind of in, I think, you know, similar to the example that you gave, you have Native Americans trying to build their own mounds, which, you know, are distinct from the mounds of these ancient Hopewell and Edina, kind of an imitation of them, just like you said, South America. Yeah. But they've forgotten really kind of the mojo to put it together. Yeah,
you can see that just in construction. You know, like I was having a conversation with someone about how they used to lay tile in the 50s. They used to lay tile in like 3 inches of concrete, and those tiles are still sitting in a lot of these bathrooms in Tennessee. They've been around, and there's guys laying tile now that do not know how to do it the way they used to do it back in the 50s.
Woodworking too, Nate. I mean, there's like some of the woodwork that was done even like turn of the century. They can't do it anymore. Like the intricate carvings, you go to some of these old places like the Civil War houses and stuff that they have here outside of Franklin where I live, and the woodworking in these houses can't be replicated by modern craftsmen, which I think it behooves what we're talking about, that... And if you subscribe to the biblical worldview, then you're talking about knowledge that was specifically passed down from this angelic host, this fallen angel, the watchers. You know, if you refer to Enoch, you know, then that knowledge could be and appears to have been lost at some point.
Which is interesting. People who don't factor in these stories into their worldview think the world is slowly getting better. And the rest of us are like, no, it's slowly getting worse. Like, technology was good.
Yeah.
We think, oh yeah, we got iPhones now, so we're getting better.
That's one of the things, and I always say this to people. I so agree with that statement, Nate. I feel like, you know, we're very arrogant. We think we're the pinnacle of civilization. I say time and time again, look at the Mayans, for example. Look at, you know, ancient Asian cultures. They were way ahead of us. I think technologically, they were a hell of a lot more advanced than we give them credit for. I always bring up this example. The Greeks, for example, had a freaking computer back 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So I think we're kind of on a decline as a civilization. You know, we're not the pinnacle. And it's kind of humbling. I think one of the benefits of doing, you know, ancient history is kind of, you know, seeing that, how these great people of the past, kind of in their own arrogance, you know, kind of fell. And, you know, are we on the same path?
Yeah. And there's a lot of imitation going on, like you were saying about some of these mounds. They're just imitating what's going on. And a lot of guests have come on and said, like, some of these people inherited some of these pyramids and other things, and they repurposed them. And so that goes along with the narrative we were just talking about, too. And how long do you think the giants were over here in America? Like, is there a time frame, you know? And how long are they battling the Native Americans? Because it seems like sometimes the Native American, the stories you hear are like Native Americans and them are battling other people. And then sometimes they're directly in conflict with the giants. It sounds like it was going on a long time. Yeah. And we don't really know how long these time frames were.
Great question. There appear to have been multiple migrations. People, Edgar Cayce, the well-known mystic, my friend Greg Little, would make arguments that, you know, there were migrations of giants from the Near East even before the time of the Assyrian Empire. So we're talking pre-722 BCE or something like that. And I think they're correct about it. I think there was multiple migrations. Why were those migrations taking place? Well, I think whenever these giants pissed off people and they got ticked and people got fed up and said they're done with them, they would drive the giants away. And so where would the giants run to? Well, they knew that they could cross the Atlantic or go by the Pacific, however, whatever route researchers would argue that they went. They knew that they could one of these routes go to North America. So I think that this was happening time and time again, especially during increased times of persecution. In my book, I argue that you kind of have this giant Israelite hybrid, in that whenever Israel is persecuted, you have these giants. And this is why so much of the culture of the giants in North America is Semitic, is similar to what we get to the culture of Israel in the Old Testament. Whenever you have, you know, for example, the Assyrian invasion in 722, the Babylonian invasion in 586 BCE, the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans in 70 CE, you have these migrations. And you can kind of see this in kind of the dating of the mound. So there's a mound, the Menorah mound, which has, and I'm going to mess this up, but it has a nine flamed menorah, which would only have happened around the time of the Hasmonean Empire. So Judah Maccabee, if you're familiar with the Apocrypha, heck, if you're familiar with Hanukkah, that's the basic story. So you can kind of date these different migrations of giants at different time periods, depending on their kind of the cultural imprint that they leave.
I mean, these mounds, there's a serpent mound, and these are very, very meant to be, these are very spiritual things, right? These are meant to
be... Yes, yes.
To ways to either connect to, honor the gods, or create magic, you know, in the dark arts. And we actually had a guy on from Minnesota who had a serpent mound on his property, and he found giant bones in it.
And a portal.
And a portal. He says, well, that's what I was getting to. He also says that there's an egg. The serpent's mouth is around an egg, and this egg is a portal. Now, Roger had some wild stories, and so...
Well, you know, it's interesting with the serpent mounds, because, and some other researchers, Frank Joseph, for example, have done some work on this. Serpent, of course, famous serpent in Genesis 3, who tempts humankind, and you have the story of the quote-unquote fall. I don't really think it's a fall, but anyway, in the Gnostic traditions that predated Christianity, and then Christianity kind of takes them as, accepts these traditions, the serpent is seen as kind of the good guy who brings wisdom and knowledge to people. But that type of religion, that type of Gnostic religion, is kind of anathema to Second Temple Judaism and to what emerges as Orthodox Christianity. So it's interesting that you have the serpent over here. For myself, I've always viewed that as proof that we had some type of whatever giants migrated, their beliefs were kind of this heretical sect, kind of proto-Gnostic sect, that just like the Gnostics that you have in early Christianity, the Ophites, the Sethites, etc., worshipped this serpent as the harbinger of wisdom. And then you have more Orthodox sites as the Menorah Mound, which is straight up whoever these giants were probably from a sect or tradition of Judaism or Second Temple Judaism. or late Israelite religion.
I mean, so do you guys see Samaria and the Babylonians as well? Because I know that in one of those traditions, and don't quote me on which one is which, but their creation story, not shockingly, has the serpent creating, which is really a false. If you subscribe to the biblical narrative, it's the deception. It's a twisting of the story, the twisting of the Genesis story or that oral tradition even before it was written down, and they're having the serpent god. If we assume that the origin of the giants is the biblical story, and the Nephilim are the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men, we can kind of assume that they are worshiping the dark. What we consider to be the dark side, right? It would be.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where I fall, at least. I mean, that's not necessarily true, but those dots line up for me. So then we see the serpent here. We have the plume serpent, right? We have all these different serpent gods.
Definitely the kind of the type of religion that would have been condemned by the biblical authors, by the authors of the Old Testament, and by early Christianity as well. So I think with some of these mounds, that is definitely going on. So you have both unorthodox giants and orthodox pious religious Jewish giants in North America.
Something that previous guest Roger actually talked about was the levels of Nephilim DNA in people, and it really if you just think about this more like a comic book, which, you know, there's some truths in the way that where comics come from. Where do they come from? They come from these ancient stories, and Marvel is consistently ripping off a lot of these ancient stories. It's pretty blatant, actually. But Roger said that the original Nephilim would be 50-50 DNA, and maybe they, and then over time, some of the giants over here, it's like they're losing that spiritual DNA slowly. So you're thinking, well, you can see it in the construction, right? Because there are, like you were saying, there are earth stoneworks in places like Montana. We've seen more and more people on our channels are sending us stuff like, hey, there are megaliths in Montana, and there are megaliths around. They didn't. Maybe the earlier ones were building with stone,
I think so. You know, it's funny because going back to Edgar Cayce, he said, he talks about the migration of early tribes of Israel to North America, but he says that there were giant groups that came here way before that, even 3000 BCE, 4000 BCE, 5000 BCE. And that's around the time where you have kind of all these lost civilizations, Lemuria, Atlantis, etc. So, you know, the giants who got here first probably had a very close connection to all that cool technology, all that cool wizardry that's mentioned in these ancient civilizations that Plato talks about, that others talk about. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Nate, that as time goes by, you know, the giants who continue to migrate here, they have already interbreeded, you know, with other ancient Near Eastern.
They're just getting dumber.
Yes. And so they've already interbreeded over in the Near East, and they're going to interbreed some more in North America with the Native Americans. So they're kind of losing.
It's like idiocracy for giants, right?
Yes.
I mean, sometimes the easiest, what is the term when it's the easiest explanation is the answer? I can't remember what the term is.
It's called KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. This is what he's talking about in football in high school.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking about, like, sometimes we overanalyze all this stuff, and it's like they could have just been getting dumber over time, guys. It's not that hard. And they're mimicking what they see. And so they're trying to recreate the knowledge of their ancients. And this kind of just reminds me of like the guy in high school who had like the record, and everyone's trying to be like the Fonz. You know what I mean? And sometimes they're doing cradle headboarding and all these other wild things. But how big do you think these giants got, the original ones? That's another thing we talk about a lot on the show. Like, some people post a lot of photos on our channels of these giant footprints and things. And then you have a lot of guys who come on, and they're so open-minded to these topics, yet they're still very, very conservative on how big these things were. But I don't know. What do you think?
Some researchers, like you said, are very cautious. So, you know, they'll say, because, I mean, you mentioned giants, and you automatically get so much ridicule. So Jim Vieira, you know, he talks about, you know, the ridicule that he got, you know, just trying to talk about, you know, giants in North America. So some researchers will be kind of very conservative and say, well, these might have been, you know, 6'5" people, but by, you know, pre-modern estimates, that would have been considered giant. I think, you know, with you put in the traditions of the Native American peoples, even up to the time of the first European settlers and those guys talking to the Native Americans, these giants were at least 7 feet tall, which kind of parallels to your small giants that you have in the Old Testament. So, for example, the random Egyptian giant that's mentioned in the Chronicler's history, he is 5 emmas, which would be about 5 emmas or 5 cubits, which would be about 7.5 feet. But some of these guys seem to be really freaking tall. For example, with Goliath, it says that his shield was like a weaver's beam. This is something that I talk a little bit about this in my own work. It's kind of it's a loom, basically. So people, it's one of the oldest sewing things that have existed in human history. Those looms have always been huge, about as big as, you know, my dining room or your living room. So that this is the size of the dude's spear means that he must have been a really, really tall person. I mean, we're talking about somebody who might have been like 12 feet or something like that. And in some of the Native American traditions, people will say, oh, this is just folklore. We have giants who are sometimes, you know, 15 or 20 feet, so very huge. Not just, you know, I think you find this throughout the traditions of giants that you have all over the world. So in Irish tradition, for example, Jack and the Beanstalk, that's a big freaking giant. You know, that's at least like a 20-foot giant. I don't think, you know, all of that is folklore. I think that this is race memory, but people remembering what these, how tall these giants were. But you also have to remember that I think you have, you know, different species of giants. Like you said, some of them are going to be directly, you know, more giant-y, if that's even a word, than others.
Giant-y.
You know, some of these, some of these other giants may have been tall people, but they were the offspring of, you know, of normal sized people and giants. So you're going to see kind of a variety amongst the sizes of giants. But in my view, I would say, basing my conclusions on Native American tradition and on what we found in the mounds themselves, usually the giants we find in the mounds are at least 7 feet tall. So I'd say 7 foot tall or higher for the North American giant.
Why do you think there seems to be a concerted effort to sweep these discoveries, these skeletons, all this evidence under the rug, and to make it disappear?
No, they have classes at Yale about this.
Yeah, maybe if you're just in the Skull and Bones.
I actually used to. It's funny. I used to actually walk by the Skull and Bones building. It's right across the street from the gym at Yale. Yeah, so I'd park my car and I walk right past it. But and it's kind of creepy because the sucker is sealed shut. Like you can't even. There's not even a freaking door.
Yeah.
That you can get into.
Did you wave at George W? You wave at George W. Sit on the porch. He was hanging out.
Yeah, I was. You know, I think I was there at the same time that his daughters were graduating, but I never saw them. I was all the way. The Divinity School's all the way up Prospect Street, so I never got to see.
So why do you think there's such a pushback and a counter narrative when there's been discoveries? We talked about tons of discoveries and mounds and in the cave, and there's yellow hair, and there's. What's the caves with the skeletons? There's all these places, even just here.
I think, Luke, there's a lot to lose in providing a more, in my opinion, a more accurate view of American history. I think the American history we have now, where, you know, there wasn't really anything here except for, you know, Native Americans hunting berries, wasn't really anything here until the European settlers came around. You know, I think that, in my opinion, very biased view of American history is so ingrained that it would take a lot for academia to change that. And I think that would have a lot of consequences, and people don't want to have to deal with the consequences of that. So they brush this stuff under the rug. And I think that's where you get a lot of pushback with giant researchers, whether it be Jim Vieira or, you know, people looking at Bigfoot. You know, we don't want an alternate view. We've gotten comfortable with the view of history that we have. And for me, that's very dangerous. And I hope that, you know,
I think that might change because, you know, we have Obama talking about, well, first I was going to say is that they just don't like gingers. Maybe that's a simple answer. They don't like gingers. They never have, but
that's a given. Nobody
but once this UFO
hate.
Stuff starts coming out, then like they have to change their, well, maybe the aliens seeded humanity.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much at stake, not just for, you know, anthropology and, you know, archaeology, but also, you know, biology. I mean, look at all this stuff that has come out. I mean, basically the government has said everything except for, you know, aliens landed on the White House lawn. We've had tons of disclosure, you know, the past year that we have never gotten in the past, you know, 50 years of UFO, you know, research. And what does that mean? Well, it means we have to re-examine this notion of evolution that we have. Was it just by chance, or was it, you know, as Francis Crick would say, was it panspermia, were aliens directly involved in creating life? So it flips a lot of things, and it overturns a lot of things that people have gotten comfortable with, people have written their dissertations, books on, people have gotten grants for. Yeah, there's a lot of implications for providing an alternate and more accurate view of human history.
It gets interesting why the whys. And, you know, it's hard because there's so many people who are so smart. And, you know, I was talking to a friend today about this. I think there's multiple types of intelligence. You know what I mean? There's people who can live in Alaska for 40 years undetected, and they know everything on how to survive. But they're not going to, yeah. You know, but nobody cares about their opinion because they haven't written books or gone to the right schools. But they probably know more about life and how to survive and valuable and just, you know what I mean? Those people aren't given the microphone in our society. And, you know, you've been to Yale and Duke and Princeton, all these places. I mean, you know. I mean, how often do these topics come up? I mean, something different has to happen in your life, because most people who come out of these systems, they have a wildly different view. And why is that?
Yeah. You know, I think that, again, you have to have your own personal impetus for this. Like you guys asked me earlier, Luke and Nate, you know, what was my impetus for getting into this stuff? You know, it didn't come from academia. I didn't learn any of this stuff in academia. I didn't even know about the Hopewell and Adena, you know, until I got out of academia. It was my own interest. And I think you have to have kind of a curiosity, because in the back of my mind, I always felt like something wasn't right about the American history that I was learning. I wanted to just see for myself if there was a different way, a more accurate way of understanding American history. Maybe there wasn't. Maybe, you know, everything I've been taught was right. But, you know, the more I looked into it myself, the more I did my own research, the more I came to see that, you know, ancient America was just as rich in its culture as, you know, Rome, Egypt, Greece, any of these ancient societies. But I think that it has to come from questioning curiosity about things. And then the problem with academia is that, you know, people, you know, we claim it, the Western world that, you know, academia is liberal-minded and that it's interested in, you know, seeking the truth. But academia has really become kind of a dogma in and of itself. You have these different sects within academia. Just look at biblical studies. You have people who say, you know, I follow this scholar, I follow that scholar, I follow that scholar. And there's not really room for free thought anymore.
Amen to that. You're talking about it a bit. I was just going to ask you, like, so when you find out that the historical narrative that you've been told is a lie, or it's not true, or it's incomplete, it's crafted, does that change how you think about everything else then?
I think it does. You know, it opens you up to go down the rabbit hole. And I don't think going down the rabbit hole is a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. I think it does.
I think it opens your mind to being like, if there is a concerted effort to tell the story this way for a reason, and you find out, wait a minute, that's not even accurate. I think it starts making you question then everything, right? You're like, okay, why are they telling us what they're telling us through the media? And why are they telling what they're telling us through? And even now, like, Nate, it's funny, Nate and I are going to ask the same question with the UFO disclosure and everything that they've been talking about these last weeks. It seems to barely blip the radar. Some people are talking about it, but there's so many other... the other things that we're told to care about more, right? And I wonder if this is going to have its day, or, you know, and I kind of don't think so. I think because what it does, and this is my own opinion, is that this space points back to the accuracy of the biblical narrative, and that is a problem for the people that are driving the prevailing narrative of the day. And I think that my opinion is that has a lot to do with why this doesn't show up, why the Smithsonian seems to disappear things.
Jim Bierra noted, you know, and I think he hit the nail directly on the head, that academia worships a religion called, you know, secularism, which was deliberately designed to kind of counter, you know, for some legitimate purposes, to counter kind of the religious narrative that you had in the West for so many hundreds of years. So to kind of counter some of the more superstitious things, but in trying to provide an alternative, it became kind of a religion itself.
Right. Well, I think we see that like without a doubt today. There's no question.
They're too closed-minded, so we're going to be closed-minded over
exactly,
here.
Exactly. So we have two closed. Yeah. So we have two closed-minded things, and you know, academia in so many areas, from biblical studies, you know, to biology, kind of the default is, I think, as Luke said, is to reject the literalness of the biblical. Of the biblical accounts. And I just find that very problematic, because I think that, you know, yes, there is allegory, there is metaphor used in some of the biblical text, but I think when you're talking about the giants and some of these other creatures, quote unquote, deemed mythological, especially in the early sources of the Old Testament, such as the Yahwist and the Elohist and et cetera, we're talking about real things that actually happened. And these are memories and events that have been preserved and passed on from generation to generation. So I think that, you know, you lose something there by just, you know, rejecting the biblical narrative as just myth and just as fantasy. Elaborate, embellished to some extent possibly, but I think that a lot of this, a lot of these narratives point to actual occurrences.
Yeah, yeah. As the show goes on, we've said it many times, but it sounds like our show, Blurry Creatures, could be called DNA Wars, because it feels like you have these multiple DNAs fighting against each other. And the weird thing about sort of this materialized version of the world is it completely discredits most of what ancient people believed. And yeah, it's like we've
but most people believed up until 100 years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah. So yeah, they've created this bubble that like completely denies what ancients thought, taught, believed, how they built. Yeah. I mean, you look at some of just the what they carved on the walls in the pyramids. It just looks and no wonder Ancient Aliens is taking off, because it looks alien. It just looks wild. It looks like it came out of some sci-fi movie in the 80s, you know?
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, I think the greatest example of this bubble is you have someone like Carl Jung, the psychiatrist, philosopher, and he's saying that, you know, flying saucers, when you start to have the proliferation of flying saucers in the 1950s, he's saying this is people are making this up in their head. This is just psychological delusion, when it's clear as day. And even he admits this towards the end of his life, that, you know, these things are popping up on radar. This isn't just something that, you know, I think I fancied in my head. Military jets are chasing these things, they're popping up on radar. These are actual physical phenomena. But, you know, like you said, Nate, he's so caught up in this bubble of just materialism, he can't, you know, let himself be open to that possibility. Open to that possibility.
And I think that bubble's about to pop, basically.
Yeah, it's got to, absolutely.
And all my friends who have muddied their own beliefs with the waters of materialism, you know, they fight me a lot on my channels, because they've been so indoctrinized by this hybridization of, oh yeah, we could put all these things together. And it's like, no, I mean, either we evolved over billions of years or we were created. And they try to hybridize everything, like, well, maybe God used it both and this and that. And it's like, I think that sets up a lot of people for spiritual failure, because I think once disclosure comes, people are going to just abandon their faith, because they've read the Bible through that materialism. They don't read the Bible the way that authors wrote the Bible.
And they intended a lot of it to be literal. Yes. You read what happened on the page is what happened.
And then Nate, the other thing too, I think on that note, is that at this time, I think we've made academia and, you know, our own intellect an idol and a god, right? And then what's happening now, and I see people deconstruct. They think they have this whole deconstruct thing. We're going to take it apart. And what they're really doing is taking the pieces they want that back up their own little echo chamber worldview, and they put them put them together to make it fit. And it's almost like if God created us in His image, what's happening now is we're trying to now create God in our image, which is the exact inverse of what actually happened. And I think it's fascinating to watch it play out. And I do think we agree with Nate and what you guys are saying, that I do think that this. There's an expiration date. I think it's gonna this whole thing is gonna implode. It has to.
As in the next 10 years, it's gonna, if the disclosure keeps happening the way back to back, and we've seen
it's conditioning. It's conditioning. Years, so. My dogs are barking, but it's conditioning, and I think that's what's happening. I think they're conditioning for us for a disclosure, and that's part of an agenda. And it sounds like crazy conspiracy stuff, but. The more you realize you're lied to, it's a house of cards. And at some point, that one of those cards, you lie enough, and it ends up breaking. The truth will come out. And I think that's why the work you're doing is so important. And I think that we're trying to get the message out and bring people like you, Adam, on that have done the work. And so it brings me to one question I was thinking of when we were talking. What do you think is the biggest piece of evidence for you? What was it, or aha, or discovery, or in your research that really was like, yep, this is it. Like, this is my smoking gun.
For me, it was the inscriptions. I'm a big language person. I teach, my main occupation is as a high school Latin teacher, but I've studied, Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic. I know those languages very, very well. In a lot of these mounds, especially the Newark Earthworks, for example, but other Hopewell and Adena mounds, they found a ton of inscriptions. And these inscriptions were for a long time dismissed as forgeries and hoaxes. But when you actually, this is not just my work, but other people, epigraphers, linguists have done this as well. When you sit down and look at these inscriptions, you'll see that they kind of are what they say they are, meaning that, this isn't something that some farmer in some field in the 19th century could have created. In fact, we didn't know Hebrew or Semitic languages well enough in the late 19th century to create these things as forgeries. So for me, these inscriptions, especially the Los Lunas Stone in New Mexico, but also the Newark Holy Stones in the Newark Earthworks. These, for me, were kind of the smoking gun that, yes, there was cultural diffusionism, that some group connected with Israel migrated over here to North America, and that because you have skeletal remains of giants in these earthworks, that these giants are also somehow connected with the Old World. With Israel as well. So I think the inscription evidence was really powerful for me. That's my smoking gun.
Love it. It's like Dr. Jed Burton.
And we've come across a lot of those stories where we posted one on our channel where they found these coffins that were 150 feet down in the ground, and they had all those markings and writings all over them too. Yeah. And they found those in, like, a lot of this stuff was unearthed in the 1800s, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. And we don't, so... Our knowledge of Hebrew really give you kind of a crash course. From 1611 around 1900, our knowledge of Hebrew basically was the same. So the 1600s when the King James Version was made, so the King James scholars, the scholars who translated that, their Hebrew was basically what we knew. And then in 1900, you get Brown Drivers Briggs, the first real big Hebrew lexicon that everybody uses now. And then it's after that that we find these discoveries in Ugarit and other places where we really get a really good grasp of Semitic languages. So if somebody's trying to forge this stuff, they wouldn't have had that knowledge back in the 19th century. That's impossible.
That's a smoking gun. That's a definitely a smoking gun.
So one of my thoughts is, this is where I'm at in my life, and what I believe is that, there's these, if there's two bloodlines are fighting against each other, one of them is trying to keep the existence of itself under wraps. Like, I feel like that's what's going on more and more as the show barrels on. It's like, this is tied to darkness, evil. It's trying to say, oh, there's nothing out there. And I think that is by design.
Yeah, I definitely think that's by design. Yeah, yeah. So keep the masses in, in ignorance. I think
distracted, looking at your phone.
To quote Kaiser Soze from The Usual Suspects, The Grace the Devil Did, is paraphrasing it. because I never get this quote right, is to make people believe he doesn't.
Convincing the world he didn't exist.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Guys are so sad. Yeah. I love
it. Oh, I know what the term was. Occam's great, razor. Great. That's what I was looking for earlier in the show. Occam's razor. Well, so along with that, one of my questions is then, with does more DNA cause them to be bigger and smarter? And that's why they, over time, they get shorter and shorter. It's like the DNA, something about the DNA causes this overgrowth. It's like gigantism, we know, is a genetic thing where they just keep growing, but it sounds...
Yeah. The pituitary gland doesn't ever turn off. But that's different, though. I think we're talking about like...
What I'm saying is, what if every ancient giant just had gigantism because of the spiritual DNA that flipped it on, and then it's just like a random thing that happens genetically in humans, but it could be every single ancient giant it was turned on.
You know, it'd be interesting to try and plot that on like a scale, but I think that, you know, I think, and it's a fascinating subject, is there a correlation between the type of culture and civilization that these giants produce when they have full-blooded giant DNA versus when they're hybrids or mixed with normal-sized persons? So, for example, Stonehenge, which I totally think was built by giants, but, you know, those massive boulders, how did they move them? And I've mentioned this in other podcasts. I think you had some giants with some big freaking heads, and that these big freaking heads had, you know, inside their brain, psychic ability to be able to move these huge stones around. And so by the time we get, you know, going back to Luke's question, by the time we get to the giants of Native America, especially the ones who come much, much later, are they not using stone so much because they're not able to, you know, move these things? They're stone around. But if you're having, you know, trouble with the local inhabitants, if you're trying to enslave them and they don't want to work, they're not going to push that stone for you. So maybe they just couldn't lift that huge stone to, you know, make these things, you know, similar to some of the more similar to the stone monuments that we see elsewhere in the world. So it would be interesting to plot that. I never even thought about that till you guys.
That is not an uncommon idea. We had, when we talked to Derek Olson about Easter Island, the folklore of Easter Island is those Moai that they moved themselves to to their resting places. It was not, they weren't slid or rolled, because he talks about how the back of these statues,
because they're completely whole. They
had been scratched up, but they're perfectly smooth. And so there wasn't a primitive way of locomotion. Yeah, something was happening, and we've had people talk about sound resonance, and whether that be that or be, you know, who knows, but psychic abilities, or even when we talk, you know, you can get the Bob Lazar thing where there's technology where that's creating a gravitational.
Yeah, the gravitational.
Yeah, like an absence of gravity that moves things forwards.
Yeah.
Who knows? Everything's on the table. But and I think also, like, when we talk about the degradation of that DNA, we're talking about pre-flood versus post-flood. It's very possible that line came through the wife of Ham, and we see that in Nimrod, and we see it on down the line, and that genotype turned on, but it would have been down the line, right? So you're having this diluting of the Nephilim DNA.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting when you have the term Nephilim in Genesis 6, they're never specifically identified with a particular nation at that time. So you have all these other nations mentioned, Sumer, et cetera, but just says the Nephilim, the fallen ones. I think that's because they come from a civilization that's so freaking old that it's not, by the time of the biblical authors, it can't be identified. But yeah, going way back.
Right. Well, if the flood wiped everything out, like, then you do lose a ton of historical record, right?
And what do you see in, like, the younger generation? You say you teach high school kids. Are there any of these kids asking any tough questions, or is it just... Is there an entire generation of program kids?
You know, I have a lot of faith in this new generation. I don't think they're programmed at all. And they question. I have, you know, students who, you know, send pictures all the time of these creatures who they, you know, say are, you know, there's visual evidence for roaming around in North America and stuff. So
you're right in our wheelhouse there.
this younger generation isn't in the bubble at all. If they see something, you know, the great thing about working with kids is in young people is that they're very honest. So, and if you get them before, you know, they're indoctrinated with kind of the secular religion of academia, you know, they can find out great things. So they're not in the bubble, and they are very open to new things. And the great thing, I think, you know, with modern technology, if they see something weird, they snap pictures of it. So, you know, and they don't just brush it under the rug. I think, you know, going back to Luke's point about what happened with all these giant skeletons and stuff, Smithsonian just brushed, you know, deliberately brushed it under the rug. And we talk, you know, a variety of reasons for that. This new generation doesn't brush things under the rug. And I think, you know, they are curious, they're inquisitive. And I think that it's going to be much different, you know, than even my Gen X generation and the generations
before. I think one of the things I've been thinking about is that it's not necessarily awareness. What it comes down to me a lot is just bravery. There's not a lot of brave people.
Yeah. I think in the new generation, there's going to be more brave people, but no, there's not. I mean, there's a lot of implications for being brave. You know, I teach at a college, but I'm not tenured. But if I was tenured and, you know, saying the stuff that I'm saying to you guys now, I'd still say it. But if I was on a tenured track, you know, it could be very problematic. You know, I probably would not get tenure.
No, you don't step out of line, right? Yeah, you can't step out of line.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Meldrum talked about that, just talking about Sasquatch, you know, like he was saying, I don't know if I would have gotten, I don't know if I would have still had a job.
And there's a lot of people, like, I mean, the you know, several of my colleagues, they have PhDs. They actually have their doctorate who do research in Bigfoot and stuff like that. So, you know, these are very highly educated people, but, you know, within academia, you are rewarded for certain ideologies and punished for others.
And we've had a lot of doctors on the show, so somehow two boneheads have been able to get all these smart people on the show.
it's our majestic beards, Nate.
We just have those Nephilim heads, I guess. You know, there's a lot of bone, not much brain. Maybe it's the opposite. Maybe they had a lot of brain.
they used to have brain. It's just diminished over time.
Yeah. Get real calcified on my part.
Yeah, so I mean, the more and more this show goes on, it seems like there's a lot of closed-minded. It's a mixture of like being smart, seeing the clues, and being brave. You got to have a lot of these things going for you in order for you to speak out and be willing to get canceled. Because a lot of these people, they do launch smear campaigns and try to discredit you. Like you were talking about Bob Lazar, Luke.
Yeah.
Look what they did to that guy.
Funny how things are coming full circle.
Right. Like a sphere. I could
think there's going to be a lot. And there's never an apology. That's the one thing that really gets me is that everybody just kind of moves on. And you're like, man, you guys, you drag people. And then.
And I think we can take comfort in kind of what Dr. Martin Luther King said, you know, the arc of the universe bends towards justice. You're bringing up Lazar, you know, everything that, you know, he said turned out, you know, 30 years later to be pretty much true.
Yeah.
The things that, you know, element, what's the element that he was mentioning?
Is it element 115?
Element 115.
115.
Element 115,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think he had that combination. You know, he was young, he was smart, and he was brave. He was willing to tell all of his friends despite.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, yeah, but he was saying Area 51 existed back in 1989. The CIA didn't disclose that until 2003. So. Yeah. You know,
but he's just kind of brave to do that. I mean, kind of crazy to build a rocket ship in your garage and then crazy to tell the world what.
Well, I think something's like the immortality of youth too, right? Like you just think you're invincible and to his credit, I think we need more people that are willing to step out of line.
Well, they're not going to have to soon, right? They're not going to have to.
The sad thing is some people don't actually get vilified until they're past their time, and that's
it just frustrates me that Obama saying the UFOs exist, and he did an interview like 2 months ago that said the most dangerous thing going on right now is the internet. You know what I mean? It's just frustrating to me because it's like he didn't talk about any of the major problems that we know are going on around, like child trafficking, and other serious issues. He says the internet is the biggest problem, and then he says, "Oh, and UFOs are here." Why do you think people are conjuring up these conspiracy theories, Obama? Like you're saying this is the problem, but then you're just casually drop, "Oh yeah, and UFOs are real too." It's like
I just can't tell anything about it.
It's like
that was his caveat. Okay.
I think he's telling us the dangerous thing about the internet is that people are going to find out the truth. That's what he's really saying. I think
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised.
But. Anyway, it's just interesting that last week he said it. That's all. It's just because I knew that they know, and we've known they know, and then now all of a sudden it's like, okay, we could talk about it.
I think the way that disclosure has been happening is very interesting. Like the Pentagon footage, which was some of the most fascinating footage I saw, you know, that was kind of a footnote on CNN when they decided to disclose it. And, you know, that was for myself one of the most important events that ever has ever happened. And they deliberately set it up just to be a footnote.
Well, I think it's interesting, though, Adam. One of the things you said is interesting, and I think you made a good point. Everyone has a phone now. It's got a camera on it. It makes it a lot harder now to really control the flow of information when everybody has. Yeah. And maybe that's why the internet's so dangerous, Nate, to your point, is that now you can't, it's not like in the 1800s where you had newspapers and you had these channels that you could really, if you wanted to, you could really control. And now it's like, we joke about this in the sports world that like the things that happened in the 90s, they got all these players in the 80s, 90s, 70s, 80s, 90s, they got away with because there weren't camera phones. Like, you know, it would never happen now. Yeah. And that's the sports world. And you're like, but this is true. Like, and we've also talked to people who say that, like, listen, like the Bigfoot thing, all these sightings, if even one is true, it changes everything. Right. Yeah. And that's the truth, though. That is the truth. And I think maybe that's what the hope is for this younger generation now, as you would say, is that you can't hide everything forever now, because like the disclosure and the Tic Tac UFO and the things been going on in Virginia for 2 years now with the Navy, all these things are just a lot of people watching with a lot of ability to record and a lot of ability to take photos. And then you get a lot of blurry, hey Nate, you get a lot of blurry photos.
It is dangerous. It's dangerous to them and the establishment, right? That's what it is. The internet's dangerous for those who are in control.
Yeah, because we can make a podcast and talk about it for now.
Yeah. Yeah. So. For now. Yeah. But these topics go together, like, right, Adam? Like,
absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
It's all related somehow, and people think, oh, you start a Bigfoot podcast. No, you started a wild and weird podcast. It just gets weird from there, right?
No, I think there's definitely connections. You know, I have always thought that we're not the only people in North America. The human, by that I mean your standard, your typical human. The Native American traditions attest to that. They've attested to that for thousands of years. The star people, the people underground. So we're not the only ones. So it's not, and I think the giants are part of that. Those different quote unquote groups that have been here for thousands of years. And I even think some of them are, you know, there's some remnants of them. Yeah, they killed most each other off. Like they killed 99% of themselves off, but some of them still exist, and Bigfoot might be a remnant of them.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Maybe they're in the bayou in Louisiana.
Could be. Yeah. There's a lot of land.
There's some stories coming out of there. Yeah. Well, Adam, it's been a pleasure, man. Like, let everybody know where they can find your work, your books. They can look you up and communicate with you, and you know, give yourself a little plug here.
So, you mentioned my Instagram account at Adam the Giant Guy. I'm always posting giant stuff on there. I also have a Facebook page, a personal Facebook page, and I also have a page for my business, which is a tutoring service in Latin, Hebrew, and Greek called Lingua Classica. My books can be found on Amazon.com. I have two textbooks, biblical studies textbooks, Perspectives on the Old Testament, and a translation from the Latin version of the Old Testament, of five books in the Old Testament called the Latin Scrolls. And then I also have my book, From Egypt to Ohio, where I talk about the giants specifically. I'm a monthly contributor to Ancient American Magazine. Shout out to Wayne May and the boys there. So I talk a lot about the ancient giants, the ancient mounds in that magazine as well.
We got to get you down to Tennessee because we got a mound here.
I'd love to. You know, I've been trying to visit, and my sons hate this because I always take them with me. So I've been trying to visit mounds on the East Coast. So there are a couple actually on the Far East Coast, Delaware and Connecticut. So I've taken my kids to both of those. And they're like, Daddy, there's nothing here but just dirt. So I do intend, and I got to see a lot of the mounds when I was in Ohio and Kentucky, but I definitely want to see the ones in Tennessee.
Yeah, you
got to
go out at night. Well. That's when Dogman and all his friends show up.
I like that.
That's when you get arrested too, then you have no more podcasts. That's exactly.
Nah, I told Luke, if we get pulled over by the cops, tell them exactly what we're doing, and they'll let us go. What are you guys doing? We're looking for Bigfoot out here. Oh, all right, these guys are honest. we're sober. We're sober. That's why we're looking for Bigfoot. We don't need it.
I think the cops will appreciate people telling the truth. So many times people
I think that's probably the best policy.
Well, Adam, thanks so much. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Till next time.
Till next time. Take care.
All right.